Thank you very much, Professor Schoen. We now have the benefit of two short comments, first from Jackie Burgess.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for a very stimulating and thought-provoking lecture, and I'm sure it's going to encourage a lot of debate. I'd like to add three points, really, as grist to the mill. I'd like you just all to think back 10 years in terms of what you were doing in 1993, and I'd like you to guess how much was being spent in the UK at that time on product advertising. You've got a piece of paper, just not lay down a figure. How much do you think was being spent in 1993 on advertising? And then how much do you think was spent last year on advertising in the UK? Right? Think about those and I'll tell you in a minute what the answer is. My three points. My first is that consumption practices are always geographically and historically specific, and that we're talking about different patterns, different meanings, different forms of regulation in different places, notwithstanding the increasing homogenisation of economic and cultural globalisation and the forces that are going on. And while it is extremely important to address the kind of psychological processes of satisfying human needs, wants and desires, I would also want to comment that those needs, wants and desires are differentiated socially and culturally, and that consumption plays a very important cultural part in terms of determining lifestyles and identity. My charity Global Action Plan, which I'm involved with, has been working for 10 years now, trying to help households and businesses to become more sustainable in their practices. And what our 10-year review shows is that UK household consumption increased by 39% in the last 10 years. At the same time, consumer debt increased by 483%. And you might like to know that we spend £4 billion every weekend on recreation and entertainment, but 10% of us are compelled to make up stories about what we did to impress our colleagues on a Monday morning. So it's not actually satisfying us. So this advertising spend, what would you reckon, 1993? Anybody willing to put up? £6 billion? Any advance on £6 billion? No, down from that. Yeah. We spent £9.1 billion on advertising in 1993. By 2003, that figure had gone up to £16.7 billion of promoting things that we might or might not want, promoting the happiness that you're talking about through the application of money and goods and products. So I think one of our questions might need to be, what strategies could we think about to counteract that all-pervasive, aggressive cultural restructuring of consumption? My second point is, I found fascinating the point that you were making about a kind of cooperative market, because it does seem to be a kind of contradiction in terms, in a way. And as I thought about that, as a geographer, there are many examples, in fact, at the local level, of collective actions to manage and regulate common property resources in conservation terms, in fishing, in logging and forestry. And there's the work of Eleanor Ostrom, which some people might know. The point about collective action, which is where people do come together to moderate their own economic demands, is that all of the examples that I can think of are actually locally based, where the participants have direct knowledge and experience of the resources and each other in terms of how they're going to manage their collective affairs. The real challenge that we face with sustainability is that we are now dealing with global environmental problems, with systemic consequences which are highly abstract and highly removed from people's everyday knowledges and experience. Take climate change for the example. So the real challenge is, how are we going to make culturally discernible, let alone culturally actionable, those kinds of consequences and actions? And I think that raises enormous problems in terms of trust, scepticism and legitimacy, especially in terms of the scientific knowledge claims that are underpinning those understandings of global impacts. And I do think that it would be as well to remember that our knowledge of the impacts of economic activity on environmental systems has only been circulating for 40 to 50 years at the outside. That compares with over 200 years of industrial capitalism, with its fundamental message that the consumption of goods and services is the only way to find comfort and happiness. My third point, I think, is one I throw up as a piece of speculation. It's something to do with the power of socio-technological systems. What we're talking about is essentially the impacts of technology, both on our ways of life, our organisations of our societies, and the unforeseen consequences of those. And I think the drive to eco-efficiency at the moment is a debate which is being couched far more in terms of controlling technology than being smart and understanding how the way in which we organise society is so deeply embedded in the technologies that we now come to use. And that raises questions, I think, in terms of what is the role of regulation, what is the role of the market, and what is the role of civil society? And I would put it to you that actually the role of regulation is to create the frameworks that protect civil society. But what we then do is that we challenge producers to innovate. And I was at a fascinating talk on Wednesday where Professor David King was putting a counter to the neoliberal economic argument. And he was arguing for innovation theory. And the fundamental insight of innovation theory is that the goal of companies is actually to drive their competitors out of business. He didn't use the word drive out. He was much more direct than that. But that was the sense of what he was talking about. And the argument was that actually is that we should leave companies to innovate and to develop new ideas, and they will do that best through the most intense competition that there can be. And that public policy doesn't even intervene at that level. Public policy intervenes in setting the regulatory framework within which this innovative activity can take place. And the core of that is to acknowledge that environmental consequences of economic activity must be controlled, because otherwise we are not going to survive the next 100, 150 years because the limits are being breached. So those are my three thoughts in terms of response to your very stimulating paper. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. Next we have David Wolf.
Thank you, Frank. First of all, like Jackie, I'd like to begin by thanking Professor Chahon for what I thought was both an extremely thoughtful and stimulating lecture, and also a very impressively clear lecture as well. I hope, having said that, you'll forgive me now for lowering the tone as a retailer by focusing on a practical example that has occurred to me when listening to the lecture. And I put it forward really as a means of testing whether we're dealing in the example that I'll give with a case of both what the professor called adverse consumption, and then perhaps whether it also points in one way towards achieving what you refer to as the paradigm of sustainability. Perhaps those are rather grand hopes, but I'll try in any case. And the example I want to give is that of packaging waste. So a pretty mundane example. And I first of all wanted to begin by contrasting the difference between our achievement on waste, packaging waste at the back of the store, in other words, in our warehouse and in the storage area behind our stores in Tesco, and packaging waste at the front of store as bought by consumers. Now, behind the store, I can sit here and give you a whole load of statistics that I think we're quite proud of in Tesco. First of all, that we, in terms of what we call our secondary packaging, the stuff that's behind the store, that encloses the materials that then go onto the front of store, we recycle more than 80% of our cardboard. We recycle around 80% of our plastic. And we've introduced a system, again, that we're very pleased with, called plastic green trays that actually replace both cardboard and disposable plastic that save some improbable volume of packaging material each year. I'm afraid I haven't got the figures. And then we use a system that we call in the jargon reverse logistics that then transports the material for recycling in the same lorries that brings the products to the store. Now that's, I think, a reasonably impressive story. When we look at in the front of the store, however, at the customer end, the story is somewhat different. The volume of packaging that is bought by consumers is going up, not down. There is more waste, more of it goes to landfill, and there is, by anybody's calculations, insufficient growth in recycling. And sometimes retailers, including Tesco, are criticised for not doing enough. And one of the curious things is, of course, that within our business, the people who are responsible for achieving what we've achieved at the back of store are the same people, by and large, who are responsible for the front of the store, but the record is very different. And I wonder if one of the reasons it's very different is because we're actually dealing with the problems that the professor referred to in terms of adverse consumption and the power of circumstances and the points that you made at the beginning of your lecture. And we have tried, actually. We're on our own brand products, we've reduced packaging and then had those competing with branded manufacturers. We tended to find, slightly to our dismay, that customers generally continue to prefer the branded, more packaged product. Secondly, we tried over the last year to have a big push on using recyclable and recycled material in our organic fruit and vegetable sales. We found that because that cost a bit more, it had a big impact on sales. In other words, sales went down, even with our organic customers, who one would expect to be the most advanced in terms of thinking. What we're grappling with now within our business is how we try and address that problem. And we always have a philosophy within Tesco that there's a difference between a bad retailer and a good retailer. A bad retailer concludes that customers are either too stupid, unreformed, or simply uninterested in doing what you would really want them to do and what you'd like them to do. And a good retailer questions why we're asking customers to do something that they simply cannot or will not do. And I think that's the approach that we've taken on this. And in this case, the conclusion that we've come to so far is that the problem lies in both a lack of incentive on the part of consumers and a lack of opportunity. Again, it's many of the points that the professor was talking about. And the challenge for us, we believe, is to try and create... It's twofold, really. It's not just for us, but it's in a sense for the whole community, both to create the desire to be sustainable and also the opportunity to be sustainable, just looking at, and I'm only focusing on this very narrow area. And we think that there's a role and responsibility for various players in trying to achieve that. And very briefly, I'll go through some of those. On the government side, we think that it would be possible, for example, for the government to, or for governments to incentivize consumers to demand or to believe in less waste, so that when they go into, for example, one of our stores, they actually begin to prefer products that are less packaged rather than products that are more packaged. And one example would be governments or local authorities saying that council tax would be reduced if households used less rubbish on an individual basis. And secondly, an incentive perhaps in the manufacturing chain to use more recycled material. And then on the retailer side, I think if those conditions existed, we would then find it much more easy than we do at present to try to sell products to consumers that have much less packaging than they have at the moment, and also to do something that we're already thinking of doing, which is to introduce much better customer recycling facilities than we've got at the moment in our stores. And our preliminary calculations are that if you put this package together, we could actually probably double or triple the amount of material that we currently collect for recycling. And I mean, the sort of really startling figure that we came to the other day was that if all this could come together, we believe that simply by upgrading our own facilities in our car parks, we could achieve 4%, that is half of the 8% increase in the UK's recycling targets between now and 2008. Now, I'm sorry if that's a very long-winded way of going around to ask the professor a question, really, as to whether that sort of approach actually moves towards what you refer to as the paradigm of sustainability, or whether I've got it all wrong. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will give Professor Schoerhorn an opportunity to respond, but I want to add a few questions from the floor. We now have about 20 minutes for questions, and feel free to ask either the speaker or the commentators or raise general observations or questions. We have two roaming mics on the side, so if you raise your hand and indicate whether you have a question. Let's start two questions there, Franz and Tim. And if you could briefly say who you are. Thank you.
Okay, mine that should work. Okay. Franz Burkert from the University of Sussex. I was also fascinated by that passage in your talk about the moderating role of civil society on markets. And I wonder whether you could say a bit more about that. Because perhaps a more common perception is that, in fact, the depth and extent of markets are increasing all the time, that more of the things we do are marketized in some kind of way. And therefore, I just wanted to ask you a question about what civil society organizations, collective action organizations, can really do in the face of that very deep dynamic.
My name is Truan Restrick. I'm from Global Action Plan. I was interested, Gerhard, in your point saying that in your sort of view of sustainability reinvented, that people could consume the same amount as now but differently, and that would lead to a sustainable solution. Whereas what we've seen over the last 10 years certainly is that despite all the many developments in eco-efficiencies, because we are consuming so much more, that's actually totally overwhelming any of the changes that are being made. And I think the whole debate about whether we consume less is an incredibly difficult debate for government, certainly for industry, and also for most people as individuals. And I wondered whether that is a debate that needs to be grasped, or whether there truly is a way that we can continue to sustain it, consume at our current levels in a sustainable manner. I think that's highly debatable.
Thank you. Let's take these questions.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the point of your question.
Which one? The
second one. Yes. Could you please...
No, I think it's more language. So do you want to do it slowly, or shall I try? Basically, the question was, in your talk, you had said that it would be one constructive path of action would be to consume the same, but to consume differently. And the question was, hasn't the data in the last 10 years shown that that's no longer feasible? So that you need to do more, you need to actually change consumption, lower it. Mm-hmm. Do you want to take those two, and if you have a response to these two first, and then we go
I would
around.
Like to answer first to Mrs. Burgess. It is true that the consumer debt have far more increased than consumption itself, and that advertising has far more increased. I am convinced that under the present paradigm of market and production, especially under the paradigm of throughput, it could not change. It's very impossible. We really need another target also for advertising. If you give advertising the task to work on sustainable production of a quite other kind, which has to be first has to be understood by people, not only by consumers but also by producers. Then, why shouldn't the expenses for advertising not grow if they were directed to the right target? And that's that is the point. Your second example about the market, successful examples of the operation of cooperative actions are locally based. I know that, it's right. And you have told about the reasons for it. It's also right that we have to do it with globalized product chains. And what we do in my research group in Wuppertal Institute is to examine one or another product chain and look where are the damages for the environment, for instance, localized in this chain, and where are the powerful stakeholders localized, and in most cases they are these two points do not fit together. They are stakeholders who can exert their influence mostly localized in developed countries, and the damage is occurring in underdeveloped countries. I think, one approach. It will take some time to be successful, but I think it's a very good possibility to try to connect the stakeholders of different countries in order to effectuate the product chain itself. And the third point was the creation of frameworks. I come back to my first remark. I think we will be successful with sustainable development if we can show producers a challenging target, naturally that should be a target where consumers and other stakeholders can speak, can be involved, but it's of no use to try and forbid something, to try and constrain behavior. The actors should have the right targets. There we have a pretty good example by Mr. North, example of packaging. The big supermarket chain succeeds to recycle 70-80% of its plastic waste. but the small retailers and the households do not, or do less. My question was, and later on you spoke of the same thing, how profitable is it for retailers and households to recycle or to help recycle waste? And by the way, how profitable is it for the supermarket chain itself? I mean, I guess the recycling you do is not of that kind that the material outcome would be of the same quality. If that would be, it were highly profitable for the company, because material cost would significantly be lower, and that should be the target. No? I think it will take lots of imagination to find out how to reach that target, especially for retailers and households. But as far as I am told by those who work scientifically and as designers on this problem, I have the hope that it will be possible. You asked what civil society organizations could do against the process of deepening the markets or the process of commercializing everyday life, which we experience today. What they can do? Naturally, they can try to make people sensible for the problem, but the difficulty is that that leads almost ever to the feeling that that people should buy less. People should I didn't get a word.
Not to they should. My German is getting worse and worse. renounce. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah. And in our society, as we are socialized, this is not pleasure to think that I should do less, get less, and so on. So here again, civil society organizations would do best if they would participate in the process of developing the new target of studying possibilities how waste could be avoided or how waste could be upcycled and bring it to the firms, or in other words, help to give them a new target, and this target will be profitable, as I said before. Sustainable consumption, if it follows the principles I have sketched, will not be the same. My imagination is not good enough to say what will change in the particular fields. I can only give examples, and I have given one maybe poor example, but well, let me take another example. Carpets,
some teppich, no?
Carpets.
Carpets will be sold no more to get into to be your to get into your ownership, but carpets will be leased, and the producer will get the carpet back at any time you want, if it is worn or if you don't like it anymore, and they will take it back and recycle it completely, so that they have far less material cost than before, and there is some hope that that employment could profit from the lowering of material costs. For the consumer, that would be, well, he still has carpets, but it will be quite different from now, for it is not in his ownership, and so with many other goods.
Carpets, but no renunciation. There are three questions. We have it over here, Vanessa, and we're here in the front, and then the gentleman in the white shirt, and then very front here.
My name is Ndidi Adosian. I'm fortunate to be a student of the good professor. I couldn't help but, I just had two observations. One is on Tesco. I was wondering whether waste management was part of social responsibility, or whether you saw it, as we were talking about, a model of capitalism, whether it's actually part of a market model, or is it just a social responsibility of the firm? And then I liked very much that we mentioned the subject of culture. It was your introduction. And in that context, I was very enraged about a book we were talking about, Culture Matters, where the African culture was presented as a model that really did not allow for development. This is the famous Huntington and Lawrence. And a lot of the comments that you made, for example, in terms of when I think about my home model, I think of property as something that is held in trust, as opposed to something that is owned with the right to destroy. Land is one of them, many, many others. I think of packaging, perhaps primitive, but I know that a lot of our food was packaged in banana leaves, which were ecologically sound. And we generally have a lot of models that we've gradually moved away from because the world has said this is not a sustainable means, you cannot grow in this way. How, again, this concept of culture, given that the world has been driven so strongly by a Western model of capitalism, which is ever increasing, especially in the globalization, the regionalization that we're dealing with, how do indigenous models survive? And for example, when you're doing your household education, do you relate back to a traditional cultural, traditional model of sustainable consumption that I know that we have in our culture, which most of the world does not know about? And how does the general model of sustainable consumption and a new collectivist type of market capitalism relate to that?
Thank you. And we have these two.
Tyler Chapman, MSc Environmental Policy at the LSE. I was wondering, Professor Cherhon, given the improvements that you've talked about, do you still think that it's possible for us to continue even in a more sustainable way indefinitely? What I'm basically asking is, do you think that we can achieve true sustainability through consumption? in the long term. Thank you.
Again, I didn't get the point.
I told you. Let's add this one.
Okay. Malcolm Eames from the Policy Studies Institute. I'd like to invite Gerhard Schoen to say a little bit more about the issues of distributional issues in terms of consumption, and particularly issues around equity. It seems to me that there's a growing literature within economics dealing with happiness and satisfaction, and increasing evidence that people's life satisfaction is directly related to the degree of equity in the society in which they live, or is inversely related to. So in the more unequal a society, the less happy people generally are. And it seems to me that there is a sort of a self-reinforcing effect there. The less happy people are, the more they consume. So I'd invite you to say something about the relationship between equity and sustainability in terms of consumption. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we can start with David.
Okay. One was directed at you.
Right. Thank you. I mean, the question was whether our approach as a business to packaging waste reduction and recycling was an act of corporate social responsibility or a market model. And I think the answer at the moment is that it's a bit of both. In terms of our back of store recycling, the part that I said was working quite effectively, it's actually part of a market model, partly as a result of regulation, because the government penalises retailers according to how much packaging they produce, but it also allows that penalty to be offset against the amount that you collect and then recycle. So there is a regulatory market mechanism there in place. In terms of customer recycling, at the moment, if we're honest, it's pretty much an act of corporate social responsibility, because what we do is provide recycling banks in our car parks for which we receive no financial return. They're operated by local authorities, and they're simply a cost on the business in terms of looking at profit and loss. I think what I think is the challenge is to try and make it more of, you know, what you describe as a market model, really, and that is to be achieved by, first of all, creating, as I put it, helping to create the desire to be sustainable on the part of consumers. So, for example, through taxation or whatever mechanisms that actually create an incentive for consumers to say, I will buy products that have got less packaging rather than more packaging, and I will recycle more. And then the role of the, and then if that is achieved, you then create a possibility for retailers or for businesses to operate through a market model, and in our case to provide better opportunities for consumers to bring their products back to our stores to be recycled. So at the moment it's a bit of both, but I think our belief is that there's scope for a market model if various parts of society and government work together.
I thought your comments were fascinating. It made me think about, well, indigenous models in a Western sense. There's a wonderful study by a woman called Ruth Schwartz Cowan, which is called More Work for Mother. And it's a study of the industrialization of the American home over the last 150 years and the loss of skills that were associated with the increased penetration of vacuum cleaners and washing machines, as well as the gender imbalances that emerged through that process. And I think one of the interesting questions, and it is a question, is it is to do with the kind of de-skilling which is going on with increasing consumption practices and levels. And that's complex, because on one hand there's a real loss of autonomy in that you know, children now can no longer cook very well, they can't sew, they can't make their own clothes, you know, they can't mend their cars. In all sorts of ways, these new sorts of technologies are actually de-skilling us in a very non-survivalist kind of way. one of the things that struck me was the chaos with the petrol strike back in 1990. Within 3 days, we had bread riots because Tesco's, God bless it, wasn't supplying bread anymore. Now, that actually says something, I think, about a basic loss of cultural competency, which is deeply significant, I think. And that concerns me, but it is also very complex. I was very struck with the professor's example of his commune in northern Italy. I have two children who are in their early 20s, and we had one of the fiercest debates over dinner that we've ever had because I expressed a desire to go and live in a commune. And my kids were appalled, absolutely appalled, that I would even contemplate such a mad kind of behaviour. So there are all sorts of generational issues here as well that are very important for us to consider.
Thank you.
That's fine.
First to the question of whether indigenous models can survive in the present course of the so-called globalization or the development of the capitalistic world system, I think they have no chance at all to survive under the present paradigm. But if markets were comprehended as common actions, as collective actions, and if production were comprehended as following the principle of metabolism, the chances were far bigger than they are now. I like to take next the third question, to tell more of distribution and and equity. Well, this is a topic which I have voluntarily omitted because it would have been too much for what I would have had to say. I think it's extremely important, it is related with the question whether firms can be brought to accept their responsibility, not only for the profits for their owners, share owners, but also their responsibility to environment and society. And I think that there is a chance to gradually convince firms of their responsibility. There are a great many of them who have begun to think over this this question, and at least in principle to say yes, but it is a long way to the end. How far that can go, I don't know, because it is not probable that responsibility of firms will be enough if they did only that what they voluntarily would do. There should, in good time, be an additional issue, and just to give an idea, that could be that corporations regard the fact that they have a certain privilege, namely they are the owners, the share owners, are only responsible for the amount of their shares. If the firm like Exxon Valdez causes a huge environmental disaster, the shareholders pay only at maximum with their shares. That's a privilege. Most people are not aware of that. It's a privilege. And when the English king founded the first corporations, they were called companies, East Indian Company and so on, to exploit the colony. When he founded them, he gave them not only this privilege, which was necessary to gather enough money, but he gave them also a charter of responsibilities. And also the first American corporations were given such a charter by the states, the American states. We could today we could have a new kind of charter for corporations in exchange for their privilege, because this privilege is the reason that capital can grow infinitely, and this in turn is one of the reasons for the increase of inequity. Now the second question was. Can sustainability be reached by consumption? My opinion is, as I told you, that it is first production what has to be changed. But no doubt, consumers always participated in unsustainable production. profit by cheap prices for oil. The oil price is undoubtedly far too cheap if we think it necessary to have enough oil in 200, 300, and 400 years, because we don't need it for cars and heatings alone, but for all sorts of chemicals. the consumer will play a very important part in changing his or her attitudes to the right level of prices. And as to the oil price, there is a group of oil experts named ESPO in England, the prognosis that the so-called Hubbard's peak, that is the point where oil extraction cannot be grow anymore. But as we know, demand will grow, and this Hubbard's peak will be in the year 2010, and that means that up to now, every person who invests in oil, say in his home heatings and or so on, has to consider what risks he runs, namely the risk of rising prices. And I am quite sure that this prognosis will, say, within 1 or 2 years, if it spreads, the knowledge spreads, will cause a very far-reaching change in consumer behavior considering oil and gasoline.
Thank you. I very much hope you'll be able to join us for a small reception next door where you have a chance to ask the speakers further questions. But before we do that, let me remind you of the next event, which will be a roundtable discussion on the 21st of June on consumption and the good life ? Where we are very pleased to have Evan Davis of the BBC and Deirdre Hutton, the chairperson of the National Consumer Council, and various other luminaries, as well as Simon Liddington, the new CEO of Research International, a global market research company, telling us about consumption. But before I close, I want to thank very, very much Gerhard Schoenhorn for stimulating paper, which ranged from ancient temples offering a lifestyle of moderation to Theodore Adorno and to our commentators who threw in considerations of packaging, corporate responsibility, communal lifestyle, and the role of civil society, and to you for discussion. Thank you very much.